So welcome. Chapter 27, The Gnostic Being. This and one more, and we've completed our study of the life divine. The last chapter, he gave us a very vivid picture of how it is that we might scale the heights, aspiring to the brilliance of the supramental consciousness as we gain level after level of advance. It isn't sufficient to live in the higher mind consciousness where we're aware of the self and it forms and fashions our thoughts for us. It isn't enough even to live in the illumined mind where thoughts recede and vision, in a sense, takes its place. Nor is the intuitive consciousness sufficient. Arriving at intuitive plane of awareness would mean a new leap for humanity, living in the radiance of truth, being able to be guided by it moment to moment, and then being able to enlarge itself into the cosmic empire of the overmental awareness. But all of these are tremendous advances over what we normally have in the mental existence of the human, where we're dogged by ignorance, where doubt interferes with every action that we take, where we're never certain of the ground upon which we walk, and whatever light we have is never sufficient to transform the darkness in which we dwell. It can only be that attaining the overmind, where we are one with the world, where we see vastly, where we can perceive above the origin of that golden light, that light of the truth, and make a way upwards to it, is the obvious next step. Intermediate is the step into the intuition, to live there. Now Sri Aurobindo, having established this broad pathway and recognized that it's a long evolution that demands great work in detail through all the parts of the being, that there will be moments of advance, moments of retreat, that we can go far, but we always live in solidarity with our fellows and with the world around, and so our advance cannot be impetuous, cannot be a radical departure from everything that is here evolving upon earth, because this is an evolution of a spiritual consciousness, and we work in oneness with it all. So we have, in a sense, to lift the entire cosmos as we advance towards the supramental. It is key for the individual to become cosmic, to be able to achieve that. Sri Aurobindo was that impersonality in the form of a personality. All manner of being could speak through him. The truths of the spirit, the wide range of consciousness, the play of delight in the little and in the large, everything was present in him. So in a way, he's the vast gateway that we can look at and see how somebody went from one stage of conscious development to another stage. So here, as we begin to read the Gnostic being, let's recognize that even in his correspondence, Sri Aurobindo does not use this term. When he's writing to people who are aspiring to practice yoga, the term doesn't enter the parlance. Here he writes in the closing chapters of The Life Divine about the Gnostic being. His audience was limited. His audience was himself and the mother, probably. He was making notations for the record, explaining to the mind, generally, of humanity, what would be necessary for us to advance into those regions of conscious being. Because the Gnostic being is a being who is based in knowledge. And as he has explained before, many hundreds of pages back, the Gnostic being will not be sufficiently grounded in the higher mind. The higher mind cannot hold the power of the Gnostic being. It is a greater evolution beyond that. So even when we have attained an awareness where we live in the higher dimension, when we are in the superior planes, when we are in what we would normally call the superconscient, it is not sufficient to be a ground of the Gnostic being, because that is a being who has not only an intimate awareness of the one and of the one at play in the many and how the many are expressions of the one, but has also some force, some prepollent power to push into the affairs of the world and effect not simply a change, but a beginning transformation. So the Gnostic being is something at this point almost unexampled on the earth. I said almost. So let's begin in Sri Aurobindo this time, as I think in the last chapter, goes back to Vedic and Vedantic sources only. Here, simply the Rig Veda. He's drawing from the first, the fifth, and the ninth mandalas. So the first is from the first mandala, the 46th verse. Pardon me, the 46th hymn. A perfect path of the truth has come into being for our journey to the other shore beyond the darkness. Path of the truth, ratasya sadhuya. Ratasya, of the truth. And rita, if you remember from when we've discussed it as a Vedic concept earlier, is not simply the truth as an essential power of knowledge, but is an ordering truth. It is a truth consciousness which has the power to affect and create a harmonic world within its vision. A perfect path of the truth has come into being. Path, sadhu, sadhu. Yes, this is connected with those who follow a path to truth. This is the root coming from the same root that the word satana comes from, that sadhak, sadhika comes from. It is to forge a path, a direct route to a goal, in this case, from darkness to light, from death to immortality. To go to the other shore beyond the darkness. The next citation is from the fifth mandala. O truth conscious, be conscious of the truth. Cleave out many streams of the truth. So this ritam chikitva speaks about something that has established awareness of the truth consciousness here. Be conscious, remain conscious of the truth, and now act, cleave out many streams of the truth. So this is an awareness of the one active here in our lives. So the Vedic rishis saw that this power can become active here on this earth. It is born above, but it can be active here. The next is, if the last verse was from a hymn to Agni, this verse is from a hymn to Agni Soma, the flame and the principle of delight. O flame, O wine, your force has become conscious. You have discovered the one light for the many. So here, a twinning of the effort of that conscious flame that's inside of us, that burns incessantly, without fuel, as is said in the preface to Sri Lalita Sahasranam. A recognition that delight and the act of growth in the world of this flame, one and the same thing. You have discovered the one light for the many. So here, we're looking at the experience of the disparate world and finding that which unifies it. And that is a movement from division towards oneness, from ignorance to knowledge, from darkness to light. The fourth citation goes back to the fifth mandala, and this one is a hymn to Usha, the hymn of the dawn, a hymn to Savitri, the power of the sun as it rises, dispelling darkness. And it says, pure white and dual in her largenesses, she follows effectively like one who knows the path of the truth and diminishes not its directions. Path of the truth, Ritasya Pantam. The next goes back to the fifth mandala. By the truth, they hold the truth that holds all. In the power of the sacrifice, in the supreme ether, Ritena Ritam Dharanam. In the power of the sacrifice, Yajnasa Sake. In the supreme ether, Parame Vyoman. And this, in a different part of the hymn, also says, this is what gives the path for the born men to become the unborn. In other words, to shed mortality and become immortal. From darkness to light, from death to immortality. Discovering the principle of oneness is the principle of eternity and time. Finally, the last citation. O immortal, thou art born in mortals in the law of the truth, of immortality, amrita, of beauty, charuna. Born from the truth, he grows by the truth, a king, a godhead, the truth, the vast. Ritena ya ritajato, a king, raja, godhead, deva, the truth, ritam, an active truth again, the vast, brahat, what is wide. And what is wide, as we know from the root, brah, means what grows, what continues to grow. Brahman, the divine word, also becomes a symbol of the power of the infinite reality. That infinite reality in the ancient Vedic and Vedantic vision is not static, but it grows. Brahman is a growing, expanding reality. And our awareness, if we become one with that, must also grow, because you become cognate with that great, immense being. And so you too have no walls. You too, subjected, enjoying constant growth. So now Sri Aurobindo begins to write. As we reach in our thought the line at which the evolution of mind into overmind passes over into an evolution of overmind into supermind, we are faced with a difficulty which amounts almost to an impossibility. For we are moved to seek for some precise idea, some clear mental description of the supramental or Gnostic existence of which evolutionary nature in the ignorance is in travail. But by crossing this extreme line of sublimated mind, the consciousness passes out of the sphere, exceeds the characteristic action, and escapes from the grasp of mental perception and knowledge. It is evident indeed that supramental nature must be a perfect integration and consummation of spiritual nature and experience. It would also contain in itself, by the very character of the evolutionary principle, though it would not be limited to that change, a total spiritualization of mundane nature. Our world experience would be taken up in this step of our evolution, and by a transformation of its parts of divinity, a creative rejection of its imperfections and disguises, reach some divine truth and plenitude. But these are general formulas and give us no precise idea of the change. Our normal perception or imagination or formulation of things spiritual and things mundane is mental. But in the Gnostic change, the evolution crosses a line beyond which there is a supreme and radical reversal of consciousness, and the standards and forms of mental cognition are no longer sufficient. It is difficult for mental thought to understand or describe supramental nature. Mental nature and mental thought are based on a consciousness of the finite. Supramental nature is in its very grain a consciousness and power of the infinite. Supramental nature sees everything from the standpoint of oneness and regards all things, even the greatest multiplicity and diversity, even what are to the mind the strongest contradictions, in the light of that oneness. Its will, ideas, feelings, sense are made of the stuff of oneness. Its actions proceed upon that basis. Mental nature, on the contrary, thinks, sees, wills, feels, senses with division as a starting point and has only a constructed understanding of unity. Even when it experiences oneness, it has to act from the oneness on a basis of limitation and difference. But the supramental, the divine life, is a life of essential, spontaneous, and inherent unity. It is impossible for the mind to forecast in detail what the supramental change must be in its parts of life action and outward behavior, or lay down for it what forms it shall create for the individual or the collective existence. For the mind acts by intellectual rule or device, or by reasoned choice of will, or by mental impulse, or in obedience to life impulse. But supramental nature does not act by mental idea or rule, or in subjection to any inferior impulse. Each of its steps is dictated by an innate spiritual vision, a comprehensive and exact penetration into the truth of all and the truth of each thing. It acts always according to inherent reality, not by the mental idea, not according to an imposed law of conduct or a constructive thought or perceptive contrivance. Its movement is calm, self-possessed, spontaneous, plastic. It arises naturally and inevitably out of a harmonic identity of the truth which is felt in the very substance of the conscious being, a spiritual substance which is universal and therefore intimately one with all that is included in its cognition of existence. A mental description of supramental nature could only express itself either in phrases which are too abstract or in mental figures which might turn it into something quite different from its reality. It would not seem to be possible, therefore, for the mind to anticipate or indicate what a supramental being shall be or how he shall act. For here, mental ideas and formulations cannot decide anything or arrive at any precise definition or determination, because they are not near enough to the law and self-vision of supramental nature. At the same time, certain deductions can be made from the very fact of this difference of nature, which might be valid at least for a general description of the passage from overmind to supermind, or might vaguely construct for us an idea of the first status of the evolutionary supramental existence. So, the mind hasn't the capacity, based on division, based on its partial grasp of reality and truth, to be able to describe what is an integrative, vast vision, supramental in character, which is at once universal and individual, reconciles all oppositions, reaches the very basis of truth, expands outward in true action to the farthest detail. Mind cannot even summon an image which replicates that. It can't even come up with a symbol of what that is. Nevertheless, Sri Aurobindo says, though we're foredoomed, we're not going to succeed, we can get a rough picture. We can get, as he says, a general description of what might be valid as the supramental evolves in existence here. This passage is the stage at which the supermind gnosis can take over the lead of the evolution from the overmind and build the first foundations of its own characteristic manifestation and unveiled activities. It must be marked, therefore, by a decisive but long-prepared transition from an evolution in the ignorance to an always progressive evolution in the knowledge. Remember the context. Sri Aurobindo is writing in roughly 1940. It was more than a decade before that that he had this descent of the overmind into the physical cells of his body on the 24th of November in 1926, which allows him to speak experientially about this passage from the overmind to the supermind gnosis. And within about a year of that transitional phase of his yoga, he discontinued writing in the record of yoga, what we call the record of yoga. But he made some notations there about the advance into the supramental consciousness, into what he called Gnostic. What he does not make clear, of course, because he never referred to this record of yoga at all during his public life, was what he meant by Gnostic in 1927, well, let's say from 1919 to 1927, and what he meant by it in 1940. He did discover early on that what he thought was Gnostic in 1919 turned out to be overmental in character and not supramental. So he had misgauged the nature of that great light above him. As he grew into it, he discovered, this is the overmind. He had not known about the overmind. He was the lone pioneer to figure that out, to assay it, to measure and map it, and to also prove that it did not have the power of transforming matter, which would be necessarily part of the supramental consciousness, because when he brought it down into his body, it greatly gave luster to the physical, expanded some of its corridors into the world, but did not transform it. He knew it was not the same thing. So always, as we're reading The Life Divine, we're seeing a digest of his own experience thrown into philosophic language, and now he's writing convincingly about what will be our future growth. He's already had 10 to 14 years of practice beyond the point at which he's writing here. He continues, it will not be a sudden revelation and effectuation of the absolute supermind and the supermental being as they are in their own plane, the swift apocalypse of a truth-conscious existence ever self-fulfilled and complete in self-knowledge. It will be the phenomenon of the supramental being descending into a world of evolutionary becoming and forming itself there, unfolding the powers of the gnosis within the terrestrial nature. This is the work that he was trying to do, to get the supramental to come down, to fix itself in his body, and then to begin to unfold its powers. It wasn't that he was going to, you know, change from a 60-year-old man to a 23-year-old man, if human you could call that being. Instead, make the truth part of the terrestrial scene and allow it to begin to unfold its secrets. This is indeed the principle of all terrestrial being, for the process of earth existence is the play of an infinite reality concealing itself first in a succession of obscurely limited, opaque, and incomplete half-figures, which, by their imperfection and character of disguise, distort the truth of which they are in labor. But afterwards, arriving more and more at half-luminous figures of itself, which can become, once there is the supramental descent, a true progressive revelation. The descent from original supermind, the assumption of evolutionary supermind, is a step which the supramental gnosis can very well undertake and accomplish without changing its own essential character. It can assume the formula of a truth-conscious existence founded in an inherent self-knowledge, but at the same time taking up into itself mental nature and nature of life and material body. So the descent is the first thing, and it can come uninhibited, in a sense, in its action once it establishes itself here. He continues, for the supermind, as the truth consciousness of the infinite, has in its dynamic principle the infinite power of a free self-determination. And you'll remember, Book 2, Chapter 1 was all about that. Its freedom to be undetermined and to yet determine itself. And this is the power that's part of the nature of true existence, Sat. It is a power of Sat's self-consciousness, Chit. It can hold all knowledge in itself, and yet put forward in formulation only what is needed at each stage of an evolution. It formulates whatever is in accordance with the divine will in manifestation and the truth of the thing to be manifested. It is by this power that it is able to hold back its knowledge, hide its character and law of action, and manifest overmind, and under overmind, a world of ignorance in which the being wills on its surface not to know, and even puts itself under the control of a pervading nescience. By this power, Retena, in other words, the power of the truth-conscious being, extends this. You can see here in this section all of these Rig Vedic citations that we started the chapter with coming into play, influencing the language that he chooses. He found only in the Rig Veda, in the most intuitive and loftiest passages of it, some sense that these rishis, at least, shared his vision of what is the nature of that and how this truth can act upon the world. How it can subject itself to darkness, how this light becomes darkness, or seems to, and then how it emerges victoriously out of the darkness, ultimately reconciling all oppositions and contradictions in a vast unity. But in this new stage, the veil thus put on will be lifted. The evolution at every step will move in the power of the truth consciousness, and its progressive determinations will be made by a conscious knowledge and not in the forms of an ignorance or inconscience. So as it emerges, it begins to fashion the forms necessary and appropriate to itself without fear of diminution or contradiction by what previously held the ground. It will win. It will change ignorance into knowledge. It will transform darkness into light. As there has been established on earth a mental consciousness and power which shapes a race of mental beings and takes up into itself all of earthly nature that is ready for the change, so now there will be established on earth a Gnostic consciousness and power which will shape a race of Gnostic spiritual beings and take up into itself all of earth nature that is ready for this new transformation. So he says that there is a coming evolution of a kind of collective being which will be based upon truth, distinguishable from the mass of humanity, who will live in a consciousness of spiritual oneness and be able to act upon the power of that. They will represent a new band of evolutionary development. It will also receive into itself from above, progressively, from its own domain of perfect light and power and beauty, all that is ready to descend from that domain into terrestrial being. And we go back to the last citation from the Rig Veda at the start of the chapter. You see how appropriately that is placed there. For the evolution proceeded in the past by the upsurging at each critical stage of a concealed power from its involution in the inconscience, but also by a descent from above, from its own plane, of that power already self-realized in its own higher natural province. In all these previous stages, there has been a division between surface self and consciousness and subliminal self and consciousness. The surface was formed mainly under the push of the upsurging force from below, by the inconscient developing a slowly emergent formulation of a concealed force of the spirit. The subliminal, partly in this way, but mainly by a simultaneous influx of the largeness of the same force from above. So, on the outside, it's an evolution out of the inconscient. From the inside, there's that higher power reaching down through the subliminal into us. It's the nexus of those two that is forming the ground of the new being, or the new element of being coming into manifestation. A mental or a vital being descended into the subliminal parts and formed from its secret station there a mental or a vital personality on the surface. So that's how it used to work in the cosmic evolution. But before the supramental change can begin, the veil between the subliminal and the surface parts must have been already broken down. The influx, the descent, will be in the entire consciousness as a whole. It will not take place partly behind a veil. The process will be no longer a concealed, obscure, and ambiguous procedure, but an open, outflowering, consciously felt and followed by the whole being in its transmutation. In other respects, the process will be identical. A supramental inflow from above, the descent of a Gnostic being into the nature, and an emergence of the concealed supramental force from below. The influx and the unveiling between them will remove what is left of the nature of the ignorance. The rule of the inconscient will disappear, for the inconscience will be changed by the outburst of the greater secret consciousness within it, the hidden light, into what it always was in reality, a sea of the secret superconscience. A first formation of a Gnostic consciousness in nature will be the consequence. So this is an estate that we are yet to own. We have not grasped that. To have the influx and the unveiling all occur openly is not something that was evident and apparent and available even to Sri Aurobindo and the Mother. So we have much to do to prepare the ground in humanity for the advance into the supramental. But this is the method, the process that Sri Aurobindo sees as being necessarily definitive. When you see this happening, you will know it's the supramental. The creation of a supramental being, nature, life on earth, will not be the sole result of this evolution. It will also carry with it the consummation of the steps that have led up to it, for it will confirm in possession of terrestrial birth, the overmind, the intuition, and the other gradations of the spiritual nature force, and establish a race of Gnostic beings and a hierarchy, a shining ladder of ascending degrees and successive constituent formations of the Gnostic light and power in earth nature. So it's interesting that he continues to formulate not the notion of an individual attaining this kind of consciousness, but of a great collective mass of such illumined beings who could be considered to establish their own race. He doesn't talk about the enginery around it, but that it is not simply to be individual, but it must also be collective. Because the collective represents, in a sense, the universe as a whole, and the individual represents the unique personality of the divine. They must be there together. The unique and the all. For the description of gnosis applies to all consciousness that is based upon truth of being and not upon the ignorance or nescience. All life and living beings ready to rise beyond the mental ignorance, but not ready yet for the supramental height, would find in a sort of echelon or a scale with overlapping degrees, their assured basis, their intermediate steps of self-formation, their expression of realized capacity of spiritual existence on the way to the supreme reality. So you begin to see that there's a staircase which is smoothed out and made more comfortable for accession. We can gain admittance to that as we are prepared in our being to advance, and we don't have to fight our way through as we have to this point, because certain victories have been won, and the unison of nature, the unity of nature, has been made real. but also the presence of the liberated and now sovereign supramental light and force at the head of evolutionary nature might be expected to have its consequences in the whole evolution. An incidence, a decisive stress, would affect the life of the lower evolutionary stages. Something of the light, something of the force would penetrate downwards and awaken into a greater action the hidden truth power everywhere in nature. A dominant principle of harmony would impose itself on the life of the ignorance. The discord, the blind seeking, the clash of struggle, the abnormal vicissitudes of exaggeration and depression and unsteady balance of the unseeing forces at work in their mixture and conflict would feel the influence and yield place to a more orderly pace and harmonic steps of the development of being, a more revealing arrangement of progressing life and consciousness, a better life order. So again, you can see that emergent within this presence of the supramental are all the leading virtues of Satchit-Ananda, beginning to come into full and dynamic play. A freer play of intuition and sympathy and understanding would enter into human life, a clearer sense of the truth of self and things, and a more enlightened dealing with the opportunities and difficulties of existence. Instead of a constant intermixed and confused struggle between the growth of consciousness and the power of the inconscience, between the forces of light and the forces of darkness, the evolution would become a graded progression from lesser light to greater light. In each stage of it, the conscious beings belonging to that stage would respond to the inner consciousness force and expand their own law of cosmic nature towards the possibility of a higher degree of that nature. This is at least a strong possibility and might be envisaged as the natural consequence of the direct action of supermind on the evolution. This intervention would not annul the evolutionary principle, for supermind has the power of withholding or keeping in reserve its force of knowledge, as well as the power of bringing it into full or partial action. But it would harmonize, steady, facilitate, tranquilize, and to a great extent, hedonize the difficult and afflicted process of the evolutionary emergence. In other words, the supramental emergence will not solve the riddle all at once. It will still give us the joy of the discovery, the eventuality of the discovery in radiant steps upwards. We're not going to be robbed of that charm, of that crescendo of this universal symphony. But we will be able to grow basically from harmony and to hedonize, as he says, the difficult and afflicted process. Hedonize, to make pleasurable, to recognize that this is a figuring of the principle of ananda, delight. So these are his opening paragraphs for this chapter. It's a long chapter. I think some 50 pages, and you may have noticed that we're beyond page 1000 now. When we turn the first page in the new edition of The Life Divine, we reached page 1000, which is itself a symbol of the infinite. So we welcome ourselves into pages 1000 plus. So we'll put our bookmark there, if you will, and we'll take this up next time. with this sentence, there is something in the nature of supermind itself that would make this great result inevitable. That's a good way to begin. Well, hope we found a good way to close tonight. Here's a passage from Savitri. This is taken from Book 1, the Book of Beginnings. Canto 3, the Yoga of the Soul's Release. He lived in the mystic space where thought is born, and will is nursed by an ethereal power, and fed on the white milk of the eternal strengths till it grows into the likeness of a god. In the witness's occult rooms with mind-built walls, on hidden interiors, lurking passages, open the windows of the inner sight. He owned the house of undivided time. Lifting the heavy curtain of the flesh, he stood upon a threshold serpent watched and peered into gleaming endless corridors, silent and listening in the silent heart for the coming of the new and the unknown. He gazed across the empty stillnesses and heard the footsteps of the undreamed idea in the far avenues of the beyond. He heard the secret voice, the word that knows, and saw the secret face that is our own. The inner planes uncovered their crystal doors. Strange powers and influences touched his life. A vision came of higher realms than ours, a consciousness of brighter fields and skies, of beings less circumscribed than brief-lived men, and subtler bodies than these passing frames. Objects too fine for our material grasp, acts vibrant with a superhuman light, and movements pushed by a superconscient force, and joys that never flowed through mortal limbs, and lovelier scenes than Earth's, and happier lives. A consciousness of beauty and of bliss, a knowledge which became what it perceived, replaced the separated sense and heart, and drew all nature into its embrace. The mind leaned out to meet the hidden worlds. Air glowed and teemed with marvelous shapes and hues. In the nostrils quivered celestial fragrances. On the tongue lingered the honey of paradise. A channel of universal harmony. Hearing was a stream of magic audience. A bed for occult sounds earth cannot hear. Out of a covert tract of slumber self, the voice came of a truth submerged, unknown, that flows beneath the cosmic surfaces, only mid an omniscient silence heard, held by intuitive heart and secret sense. It caught the burden of secrecies, sealed and dumb. It voiced the unfulfilled demand of earth and the song of promise of unrealized heavens and all that hides in an omnipotent sleep. Namaste, Jai Ma.